This is a great picture you're painting of 1950s Bend.
Yeah.
It sounds like a definitely kind of a Wild West town at that point.
Follow up on the prostitutes. The senior madam who'd been there for years, a lady by the name of Catherine. I never knew her last name. I don't suppose anybody did, but she ran the houses, and she had a little drinking problem, and she drove off one of the irrigation canal bridges and into the irrigation canal and drowned one night. And she had a beautiful home south of town, and she and her estate sold that home to some people. And sometime later, those people came into my office saying they weren't sure about the property they'd bought. They couldn't understand why men kept coming all hours of the day and night to the house, knocking on the door looking for Catherine or somebody else. And they had finally concluded that they had bought a home of a former madam, which I advised them, yes, they had. I hadn't had anything to do with that sale. And naturally, they wanted out because those things don't wear off. And so I filed a lawsuit to set aside the sale on the grounds of fraud and a failure to disclose that. And they promptly agreed and rescinded the sale. It was kind of embarrassing. He had a family and young kids and people had come around in the middle of the night knocking on the door asking for the girls.
What finally happened to that property then?
Well, I think they disclosed it the next time and somebody bought it who was willing to put up with it, and time probably finally wore it out. It was a pretty nice house, big old white two-story house.
Uh-huh. Now, you'd mentioned when we first talked that you'd immediately became involved with several civic organizations and other organizations in Bend, including the Lions and COC. I had that in my notes.
Central Oregon Community College.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. And of course the church and also the Boy mm-hmm. Scouts. Maybe we can take them one at a time. What sort of outfit was the Lions Club in those days?
It was a wonderful organization, composed only of men. Women never even thought about being in it. It met Tuesday at noon downtown in Bend, a restaurant for lunch. Fine, public-spirited men. Had constant good projects, glasses for needy kids, dental things. They were constantly raising money, doing good things for the community. It was a great organization. Mm-hmm. Probably, I would guess there were probably 25 or 30 members of the Lions Club when I joined it, and got up to maybe twice that high by the time I left Bend.
Mm-hmm. So it would include local business leaders mm-hmm. for the most part, I would assume, and other attorneys as well?
Yes, other attorneys, doctors, professional people, business people.
Mm-hmm. What about Boy Scouts?
The Boy Scouts, I was a Boy Scout leader for a number of years through the church. The church had a scout troop. They sponsored a scout troop, and I was a scout master for that troop for probably 6 or 7 years. Mm-hmm.
You take them out into the woods and on weekends mm-hmm. and stuff?
Take them out in the summer, and we'd always have one winter camp out in the snow, so they'd learn how to handle the snow and get along under difficult conditions. Always a good experience. The kids never seemed to mind the cold very much. Most of us who were scout leaders would be huddled around the fire in the evening and trying to keep warm and afraid to go to bed because it was too cold. And I remember one night one of the kids, Joe Schell, 12, 13 years old, he had his little pup tent set up 50, 100 yards away from the camp. And he comes walking up to the fire where we were all sitting around, uh, in his shorts and barefooted, walking through the snow. And I said, what's the matter with you, Joe? Are you cold? No, I'm just hungry, he said. Need something to eat. But get back to bed. You're going to freeze to death.
Looking for his midnight snack.
But I thought that was typical. The kids loved it. They liked the winter camps as well as the summer camps.
Mm-hmm. And what about yourself? Did you enjoy those outings?
I really did. I enjoyed them very much. One time we got a scout stuck halfway up on Fort Rock. Did you ever see Fort Rock? Fort Rock's a wonderful escarpment down south of Bend towards what's now Christmas Valley, and a terrific high, probably a 300-foot high cliff, and this kid had climbed up about halfway and then got scared and froze and couldn't go up or down. And we rushed into the Fort Rock store and got enough rope to hang down, and one of the scoutmasters, not me, one of them, climbed up and tied that rope around his waist and arms, and we hoisted him on up, you know, scary. I mean, we just, some of us stayed there and talked to him to just keep him quiet, standing there quietly, because he got so afraid he couldn't move, and we were afraid he was going to fall, and it would have been bad.
So you hoisted him up to the top of the rock?
Up to the top, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, he'd gotten within, as I remember, we got about 150 feet of rope or something like that, and I think he was probably 100 feet down from the top when we pulled him up.
Uh-huh. So was there road access to the top there?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. He could go around the other way and get up there.
Uh-huh. Did you do any camping outdoors apart from your involvement with the Scouts?
Yes, it was a camping area. We spent a lot of time camped out. As my kids grew up, they had 4-H horses, and we would go out and with the horses camped out. Other times we'd just go on fishing, camping trips. I never camped out hunting. We'd go hunting. We hunted ducks and geese and quail, but those were day trips up the river or down to Summer Lake or Silver Lake. But fishing trips, we would go up to the Metolius area and camp out and fish.
Mm-hmm. Well, sounds like a good life.
It really was a good life for the kids. The schools, of course, then in those days didn't have the kind of problems they have now. We didn't know what, drugs weren't a problem at all. Crime was rather modest, very minor around Bend.
You became involved with the church there too?
Yes, I was always active in the church and on the board of elders for the church.
This was the Presbyterian,
Presbyterian
church?
First Presbyterian, excuse me.
I'm wondering now, you've told me a little bit about some of the attorneys, and a few other names have come up, but is there any other notable figures in Bend that you might offer a profile of now?
No, I don't think of anyone offhand. There was a, there are a couple. Robert Sawyer was editor of what was then the Bend Bulletin, and he owned the Bend Bulletin. Robert Sawyer, in my judgment, was one of the last newspaper owners and editors who was able to report and publish his paper on a very objective basis. He would not print any story unless he had someone check it out very carefully to make sure it was true. He didn't make a lot of money with the paper, but he did well. But he ran that paper with very strict ethics. He would not publish something just because somebody said something, you know. And many times he would call somebody down to his library where on Drake Road there on the Deschutes River. He had a beautiful big home. And I remember being called down there and put on the carpet about stories, the accuracy of stories, both ones that I was involved in and ones that other people were involved in. What did I think about them? I had tremendous admiration for him because of that. He made his editorial decisions very carefully and with the highest ethics. He wouldn't print anything in his paper that he thought was scurrilous or defamatory unless he was absolutely sure that it was true. Newspaper publishers since that time haven't had that option. They have to sell papers, and the way to sell papers is to have a spectacular story. But he was succeeded by a very fine man who's still there, a fellow by the name of Bob Chandler, bought the Ben Bulletin, changed the name ultimately to the Bulletin, and has become a very famous man throughout the United States. I remember when he left Ben to go for 2 years to consult with the Los Angeles Times about some of their problems. So he was hired as an expert. He's past president of the newspaper publishers in the United States, a very outstanding man, mm-hmm. very outspoken, different than Sawyer, flamboyant, constantly was attacking everyone, attacked the dentists, attacked the lawyers, attacked the doctors, had plenty of criticism for everybody in his editorial page. But he's done a great job with the paper, and he's been a great philanthropist for Oregon. He's been president of the Oregon Community Foundation, and a fine man. Mm-hmm. Two good owners of that paper.
Mm-hmm. Bob Chandler, I believe, was also early friend and supporter of Mark Hatfield's, if I'm not mistaken, or at least his name came up.
Yes,
we were doing
Hatfield. He's supported a lot of people. Nobody ever accused him of being diplomatic. He's very outspoken, very brusque, but he always has said very quickly exactly what he thought and what he would do, and he stayed right with that. He ran for Congress one time. I went with him on a campaign trip, tried to help him a little bit. It was absolutely hopeless. I mean, he would insult the waitresses. He would say anything he thought. He was not a politician. He didn't get elected.
A little too open.
A little too straightforward, yeah. Of course, in recent years, Don Kerr has, I got a couple more. Don Kerr has made a great contribution to the community in the area through the High Desert Museum. He's been the leading force in that, which is now a great institution. Don was just a very young kid when he came to me and asked me to be on the board, and I listened to him and told him it was the craziest idea I'd ever heard, wouldn't work, and he better figure out something else to do. And he said, well, can I come back and see you with some plans and show you what I've got in mind? Yeah, you're so enthusiastic, I'll listen to you, but I don't think I'll change. He came back a few months later with all these wonderful plans and diagrams, and I said, well, Don, I still don't think it'll work, but you're so enthusiastic, I'm willing to take a chance with you. So I went on the board. Almost everybody else in Bend had turned him down. He had good friends here in Portland that helped him. But ultimately, everybody that he wanted to come on the board finally did, and it's turned out to be a great organization, in spite of my dire predictions. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, the real hero in Bend was Bill Healy. Bill Healy, who really was the moving force behind Mount Bachelor. Bill was a longtime, very close friend and client of mine. Mount Bachelor was a client of mine. Bill had a great life in spite of his terrible problems in the last years of his life. He was an extremely courageous guy, fought through one of the most difficult problems anybody could ever have physically for about 7 or 8 years before he finally died,
and
crippled.
What was that problem?
I don't know that they ever really knew. It was some kind of a nervous disorder similar to multiple sclerosis. It was a nervous degenerative situation that put him in a wheelchair, got him so he couldn't talk. He had to communicate by a Ouija board. But he never lost his courage, and he ran Mount Bachelor right up to near the end from his wheelchair and with his Ouija board and a typewriter that he could hack out some things. Great wife that stayed with him and helped him. I would say that of everybody that's lived in Bend and since I've been acquainted with it, he's the number one hero. Everybody loved him. I have to tell you a good story about Bill Healy. Being an Irishman, he liked to drink a little. We drank a little together occasionally. One night, he was having a Mount Bachelor annual stockholders meeting, and Senator Hatfield was going to speak to the group. And the senator was late because there was heavy snow over the mountains, and he didn't get there. And Bill kept drinking, you know, and he finally the senator got there, and Bill was introducing him, but he had a little too much then, and the senator made a great speech. And afterwards, I said, "Come on, Bill, we'll take you home, my wife and I." And, "No," he said, "I'm going to stay here a little while longer." So he went back to the bar, you know. Well, about 2:30 in the morning, I got a call from the city police to come down to the... Is that going through all right?
Yeah, you're fine.
To come down to the police station. They had Bill Healy down there. Well, I went down, and here's Bill. And he's just as happy as can be. He's telling them stories, and his officers are laughing and listening to him, you know. And finally one of them said, I'd been there a half hour then, and finally one of them said, "Well, maybe we better do this breathalyzer." And so they did the breathalyzer, and it came out 0.12, and 0.10 was the limit then.
And they picked him up when he was in his car, is that it?
Yes, they stopped him for driving while under the influence. And so one of the officers said, "Well, these ampules don't always work right." He said, "Let's wait a little while and take another one." And they were letting him have drinks of water and a little coffee and so forth. And so we talked for another half hour or so. And "Well, let's take another one of these." And so they took it, and this one was 0.11. And the officer said, "Well, I just don't trust this machine at all." He said, we'll take another one in a little bit." So we talked some more, and Bill was telling them all along, you know, he wasn't mad about them arresting him. They should have arrested him. He had it coming, you know, I mean, it was just the most wonderful thing. Contrary to most of my visits to help a client that had rested, usually they're ornery and surly, Bill was just happy and having fun, you know. And so they took it again, and it was between 0.10 and 0.11. And once again, the officer said, well, these machines have been here. Bill said, now, Joe, I know what you're trying to do, but it won't work. He said, I'm guilty. Let's get this over with. He said, I appreciate what you're trying to do, but you've got a job to do, and I'm guilty. And so they said, okay, all right. So his wife had flown in from back east somewhere, and she was at the police station by the time we finished. And she was such a wonderful lady. She very cheerfully took him on home. They were leaving the next day to go on vacation. He'd been working too hard, so he was kind of celebrating. And they were going to Hawaii the next day. So they took off on the plane, went to Hawaii for vacation. And about 2 days later, the city attorney called me up, and he said, you'll never guess what's happened. He said, I've never seen or heard anything like this, but the officers came into me with an old provision in the city ordinance that says if they want to, they can hold these charges, and if he doesn't have a problem for a year, there won't be any prosecution. If he does, then they can bring these charges back up again. And with your permission, we'd like not to prosecute him. And I said, well, that's wonderful. I know that's all right with my client. So I called Bill in Hawaii. And Bill said, Owen, I don't know how you did it, but I really appreciate it. You're a genius. And I said, Bill, I didn't do anything. I didn't do anything. I'm telling you what happened. No, he said, I don't know if you paid somebody off. If you did, I don't want to know about it. And I said, Bill, I didn't do anything. He never would believe that that's what really happened. Those officers did not want to prosecute him. He was so popular and such a nice guy. Uh-huh. He is a top-notch guy.
So his popularity came from the fact that he was a nice guy, and also because Batchelor was so successful?
Both. He was a great manager of Batchelor. His employees all liked him. He had a great sense of humor. He loved everybody. I never really saw him mad at anyone. he had a way about him that was unbelievable. I would go to Forest Service meetings with him when he wanted something out of the Forest Service, and he would never push them, crowd them, threaten them like so many clients, but he always got his way. In other words, he just had a touch. When he announced he was going to build, he told me, we're going to build a lift to the top of Mount Batchelor. I said, Bill, Forest Service will never agree to that. I know they won't, but we're going to go talk to them. So we went down, and Bill had all these beautiful plans and go to the top of Mount Batchelor. Oh, I don't think so, Bill, you know, and we'll give you an answer, but, and he said, well, you fellows are the experts, you know what to do, you know. So a few months went by, and Bill came back in, and he said, let's get that lift built to the top of Batchelor. And I said, Bill, you got to have a better lawyer than I am to do it. I don't think I can do that. And he said, well, I got an idea. Come on, let's go see the supervisor and the chief of recreation and so forth. So we go down, and Bill says, well, I understand why you don't want me to build to the top of Mount Batchelor. You think it's not safe and the equipment won't stand up. He said, we've done all these studies and we're satisfied they will, and here's all the engineering detail. But I understand that you don't want it done, and if you don't want it done, then there's no alternative for us but to go up into Broken Top. So here are the plans to build a lift up into Broken Top. and the supervisor said, oh, that'll never work. Well, we're going to have to expand. You can't hold us down. We're moving too fast. Well, within a few weeks, he had his permit to go to the top of Mount Bachelor, you know. And he never even thought about going into Broken Top, but he just gave them an option to let him do it. And
of course, they could have stopped him from going to Broken Top too.
Well, they could have, but they liked him enough, and he made a strong enough case that we have to expand. We can't just stay where we are. We have to expand. And he was right, you know, and they recognized it finally. Mm-hmm. And he told them then too, we're going to take the whole mountain. In other words, when we go to the top, ultimately Mount Bachelor will have a circular route for vehicle around the mountain, and everybody can ski wherever they want to, 360 degrees, which will ultimately happen. He is like a lot of my good clients. When he wanted to do something, he figured out how to get it done. He didn't need a lot of legal help to do it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Were there any other cases involving him or Bachelor that stand out in your mind?
Yes, they built a housing unit up there, 40 units up on Overnight Lodge up there. And it didn't work out very well. Forest Service didn't like it. Bill decided it wasn't working very good, and so he told the board, the Forest Service doesn't like this, we're going to tear it down. Oh, we can't tear that down, it costs too much money, you know. No, we're going to tear it down. We're going to make the Forest Service happy this time, tear it down. So they did. He invariably met with resistance on all of his expansions at Mount Bachelor from a conservative, smart board, and wonderful board, smart men, but they just never were that excited to spend the kind of money that he wanted to spend. But he always, with great diplomacy, always had his way, and everybody went along, and it always turned out to be right, you know.
Maybe now would be a good time to ask you about some of your other early cases. I mean, I realize some of these you've just told me about may not have been that early in the game, but can you remember, you know, what maybe your earliest cases were that seem you know, seem notable at this point? You discussed with me earlier a few that mm-hmm. I think were fairly early in the game. There was the Mitchell Flood case, mm-hmm. and you said you tried a couple of murder cases in Los mm-hmm. Angeles, I guess.
Mm-hmm. One in Los Angeles. The Mitchell Flood cases probably were the start of a different era in my career. The highway built a fill and a highway through Bridge Creek across from Mitchell. And when they built it, the Mitchell people told them they were going to flood them out because they were restricting the channel too severely with their tremendous fill that was up higher than the town. And when they had a water spout, which they have regularly in Mitchell, the water comes down and it wouldn't, that rock, big boulder rock fill they put in wouldn't give, and the water would be forced over through the town. And sure, but the highway department knew better, naturally, and so they went ahead and built the highway. And sure enough, a tremendous water spout came along and washed out a good many of the businesses in Mitchell. Behind you is a picture of Mitchell before it was washed out. And those people, there were 11 of them that lost their businesses or homes or a combination of both. They began to look for a lawyer to sue the state. Well, a number of lawyers turned them down, that there wasn't anything they could do. You couldn't sue the state for that. Ultimately, about a half dozen of them came to me, and I told them that I thought it was worth a try, that there was a theory in Oregon that had been slightly touched on called inverse condemnation. That is, when the state does something that causes the loss of property and didn't do it by eminent domain, that the effect was that the property owners were entitled to recover from the state. It was a little bit of a tenuous theory.
Okay. Hold on, we'll switch the tapes here.